had left people unprotected against unscrupulous money changers. Then, as the downward spiral deepened, leadership refused to take sufficient remedial measures, remaining passive at the very time robust leadership was needed most. Restoration would come through a leadership of frankness and vigor, just as such leadership had carried the people through every dark hour of our national life. With such a renewal, he was certain that the American people would once again rise. Infuse a sense of shared purpose and direction. As befitted this grave moment of communal bonding, Roosevelt's language was perfectly pitched to the occasion. Elevated and religious, yet without affectation. At the center of his speech, he called for a new contract between the leader and the people. A contract built upon the recognition of our dependence on one another. We must move forward as a trained and loyal army, willing to sacrifice for the common good, displaying a unity of duty hitherto evoked only in time of armed strife. He considered his election by the people their gift to him. In return, he would work to fulfill their request for discipline and direction under leadership. And in the spirit of that bequest, he pledged, "On my part and yours, we face our common difficulties." Foremost, he understood that the nation asks for action, and action now. Accordingly, he promised that he would put people back to work, provide a sound currency, prevent foreclosures of homes and farms, and put an end to speculation with other people's money. As ever, immediately beneath the skin of vision lay the sinew and bone of pragmatic action. Tell people what they can expect and what is expected of them. He told the country he was prepared to recommend to Congress a series of measures that a stricken nation required. If the members should fail to respond to the unprecedented need for undelayed action, however, he would ask Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis, broad executive authority to wage a war against the emergency, as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe. Here, he harked back to the tradition of Abraham Lincoln, who issued the Emancipation Proclamation as an executive order based on his powers as Commander-in-Chief, and to Theodore Roosevelt, who saw himself as the steward of the people, an office giving him the warrant to do whatever the people needed, unless expressly forbidden by the Constitution or the laws. This was no dictator or messiah holding forth. Franklin Roosevelt spoke in the name of the people, for a resurgence of the strength of democracy, for a constitutional system capable of meeting every stress without losing its essential form. To emphasize that each of his cabinet appointees was part of an ensemble, he gathered them together at the White House that evening, 9 men and 1 woman, to be sworn in by Supreme Court Justice Benjamin Cardozo. Never before has the cabinet been sworn in at the same time and in the same place and by the same official administering the oaths, the New York Times observed. Postmaster General James Farley would remember the scene in detail. The new president sat at his desk, a beaming smile on his face, and read out one by one the name of each member of his official family. After each member was sworn in, he extended an exuberant handshake and handed over the commission. "This is a strictly family party," he said when the communal oath-taking was completed. He trusted that they would all be able to pull together, without friction, and to work shoulder to shoulder for the common good and the best interests of the nation. With this informal little touch, Farley recalled, The chief executive had successfully converted what is usually a stiff and pompous ceremonial into a friendly, happy occasion. The day's work was not yet done, however. By that evening, Roosevelt had reached two significant decisions. If a constitutional method could be discovered for obtaining jurisdiction over the entire banking system of the nation, he would, as his first act, declare a uniform shutdown of the banks, ironically called a bank holiday. He asked his Attorney General and Treasury Secretary to be ready the next day at the first formal cabinet meeting to outline a constitutional method of closing all banks. With this power in hand, he would then convene a special session of Congress, both to validate his action and to craft a legislative plan for reopening banks in an orderly manner, depending on their degree of solvency. There would be no sleep that night for the members of Roosevelt's team. In a way that defies all probability and logic, this man, who had arduously rebuilt his own body and regained a spirit of confident optimism, was chosen to rebuild the entire body politic and endeavor to resuscitate its spirit. That such a man was suited for such a task at such a time informed his leadership with something ineffable, something approaching enchantment. That magic of leadership was contagious, a young lawyer who had joined the administration remembered. As if the air suddenly changed, the wind blew through corridors. A 500,000 letters of support and encouragement were on their way to the White House. "It seemed to give the people, as well as myself, hope," one citizen wrote, "a new hold on life." This atmospheric change, the sense that life was resuming, was reiterated in headlines and commentary across the country. "The era of inaction has come to an end. The government still lives. Perhaps a leader has come." Lead by example. Franklin Roosevelt's compelling and authentic performance on day one had been decades in the making. The young boy who had concealed an ugly gash on his forehead beneath his cap so as not to worry his ailing father. The polio victim who conveyed relentless good cheer to shield his family had fashioned no mere mask, but an outward demeanor of serenity, confidence, and relaxation, however grave the maelstrom that encircled him. Because strenuous thought and anxiety were not etched into Roosevelt's features, as with Abraham Lincoln, people confused the projected surface for the interior. "How does your husband think?" reporter John Gunther asked Eleanor Roosevelt. "My dear Mr. Gunther, the president never thinks. He decides." Yet the picture of Roosevelt as a prodigy, a natural, a purely instinctive leader, belies the long periods of hard thought and preparation that went into everything he said or did. "Nobody knows how that man worked," Eleanor's friend Marion Dickerman had said, after watching him struggle for hours in his library, rehearsing the short distance he would have to traverse in order to reach the stage at the Democratic National Convention for his first public speech after having contracted polio. "I never saw a man who worked harder," Sam Rosenman said of Roosevelt during his years as governor, recalling the long sessions at Hyde Park when he would shoot questions at a rapid clip at experts in various fields, absorbing vast stores of information, deepening his knowledge of every policy area. "The remarkable thing about him," California Senator Hiram Johnson observed to Franklin Roosevelt, "was his readiness to assume responsibility and his taking that responsibility with a smile." If the new president had long since learned to make himself appear confident in order to become confident, might not the characteristic uplifted tilt of his head, the sparkle of his eye, his dazzling smile, and his assured calm voice soothe and embolden the fragile nerves of the country at large? In a time of ubiquitous loss and uncertainty, such a halcyon projection was no small gift to the people of America. Forge a team aligned with action and change. That Franklin Roosevelt had assembled no team of rivals was abundantly clear when his cabinet held its first formal meeting on Sunday afternoon. Without doubt and by design, the president was the patriarch of this official family. Where, critics asked, were the big men, the luminaries with familiar names and large reputations, the likely presidential possibilities? On first blush, it seemed as if the members had been selected on the basis of loyalty from among those who had supported him for the nomination. Most of them were friends he had worked with over the years. On closer inspection, the pattern behind Roosevelt's cabinet emerges. The obvious cabinet choices, the persons of distinction in the Democratic Party, were affiliated with the old order, set in party lines, set against change. In the face of worsening crisis, they had tread water too long, mired in orthodoxy, waiting for the economic down cycle to peter out and the wheel to turn. The family team Roosevelt needed must be open to whatever shifts and exigencies the future might bring. However various the geographic and political composition of the cabinet, they shared a common trait. Whether Democrats or Republicans, liberals or conservatives, Easterners or Westerners, they manifested a decided bias for action, an allegiance to whatever might be deemed necessary to get the country out of its misery. Through this gallery of associates, Roosevelt hoped to introduce a new mind into the government, a new adventurous spirit, and unquestionably, he was the boss on this adventure. Slated for Attorney General until his sudden death from a heart attack on his way to the inauguration was Montana's Thomas Walsh, the liberal crusader who had exposed the Teapot Dome scandal. Connecticut lawyer Homer Cummings, strongly in favor of federal relief for the unemployed, took his place. For Treasury, Roosevelt selected Republican businessman William Wooden, a fellow trustee of the Warm Springs Foundation, a man of teeming energy and possessed of an unusually fertile mind. To fill Interior and Agriculture, he chose two progressive Republicans, Harold Ickes and Henry Wallace. For Labor Secretary, he picked Liberal Democrat Francis Perkins, his industrial commissioner in New York, whose positive, innovative spirit, intelligence, and work ethic he had witnessed firsthand during his first two terms as New York's governor. When first approached, Perkins hesitated. Labor has always had, and would expect to have, one of its own people as secretary. Roosevelt replied that it was time to consider all working people, organized and unorganized. So Perkins became the first female cabinet officer in history, allowing Roosevelt to break yet another convention. The question arose, what should she be called? Was there a female title corresponding to Mr. Secretary? Robert's Rules of Orders suggested Madam Secretary, which was fine with Perkins, although she cringed when reporters occasionally referred to her as the Madam. Within the cabinet, Perkins happily recounted, she never experienced any suggestion of a patronizing note. Though at one point when the Secretary of Navy was about to tell a story, he held back, wondering if it were appropriate for a lady to hear. "Go on," said the President. "She's dying to hear it." Create a gathering pause, a window of time. At the first formal cabinet meeting that Sunday afternoon, Perkins recalled, "The president outlined, more coherently than I had heard it outlined before, just what this banking crisis was and what the legal problems involved were. Turning to his attorney general, who had spent the entire night searching for a constitutional method that would allow the federal government to take over the banks, Roosevelt was delighted to hear that an obscure 1917 precedent had been unearthed, authorizing the president to investigate and regulate hoarding of currency. Upon this sliver of authority, the New York Times observed, was built the most drastic peacetime exercise of presidential power ever taken. Without a note of dissent, the cabinet fell in line, and work began at once on a presidential proclamation establishing a four-day bank holiday that would eventually stretch into a week. The holiday provided a window of time, an anesthetic before the major operation, a breathing space to devise a plan to reopen the banks in an orderly way. The coordinated closing, historian Arthur Schlesinger remarked, gave the long economic slide the punctuation of a full stop, as if this were the bottom, and hereafter things could only turn upward. Bring all stakeholders aboard. Midway through the cabinet meeting, Roosevelt brought in congressional leaders from both parties to solicit their support for his plan to call the 73rd Congress into special session to enact emergency banking legislation. In the era before the inaugural date was changed from March 4th to January 20th, Congress would not ordinarily have been called into session until the following December. The singular exception was July 1861, when Lincoln called a special session to deal with the outbreak of civil war. To accommodate the return of far-flung members to the Capitol, Roosevelt set Thursday, March 9th as the date for Congress to convene. That same Sunday, at Roosevelt's invitation, a group of prominent bankers from New York, Philadelphia, Richmond, and Chicago arrived in Washington to lend the administration a hand in the drafting of the bill. Progressives, who had hoped for radical action, even nationalization of the banks, were disturbed by the administration's decision to consult the very men impugned as unscrupulous money changers in the inaugural speech. But Roosevelt knew that he needed the technical expertise and support of the banking community, and felt it important to include them in the process of drafting the bill. The search for technical knowledge also led him to heed members of former President Hoover's Treasury Department. While this too ran counter to the spirit of the moment, these staffers had wrestled for months with various plans for saving the banks. Repeatedly frustrated by Hoover's inaction, they were eager to contribute. To round out his search for consensus, Roosevelt invited the nation's governors to meet with his entire cabinet at the White House the following morning. He wanted to provide them a complete picture of the banking situation, in the hope of securing their help and cooperation. Acting swiftly, the governors passed a series of resolutions, pledging their full support. And so, layer by layer, stitch by stitch, Roosevelt gathered into his materializing contingency plans not only his executive team, but congressional leaders, leading bankers, and state governors, a consensus of various levels of leadership, public and private. And all the while, he was planning novel ways to appeal, appease, and encourage the most important stakeholders of all, the American people. Set a deadline and drive full bore to meet it. The new president had promised action. Only a single week separated the proclamation of the national bank holiday on Monday morning, March 6th, and the scheduled reopening of the banks on Monday, March 13th. In that brief space, his team had to prepare, rehearse, and produce what would amount to the staging of a national drama aimed at restoring public confidence in the nation's failed banking system. The entire country would be in attendance when the production had its debut on March 13th, and their response that single day would determine success or failure. What if the emergency legislation were not completed and enacted in time? What if the people did not believe in the soundness of the plan? What if, on Monday morning, mobs of depositors all over the country stormed their banks? The outcome was anything but certain for both the banking system and the fledgling administration. An enormous mountain of data had to be sifted and organized, pressing decisions made and funneled into a comprehensible language for an emergency banking bill ready for Congress. A preliminary decision was made to reopen the banks in stages dependent upon their financial stability. But who should make those determinations? What if banks had solid assets but insufficient currency to meet demand? Should the federal government provide additional currency against those assets? If so, should it be scrip or newly printed money? How could such currency be printed and distributed in time? If insolvent banks with impaired assets had to be closed, how could depositors be treated in a just and orderly way?
Everyone was aware that in the rush, serious mistakes might be made, Roosevelt advisor Raymond Moley acknowledged. Some banks would be reopened that should have remained closed, and others would be closed that might have weathered the storm.
One thing was incontestable. Under the new legislation, it would be necessary to concede a massive consolidation of power to the executive branch. The Marathon Week called for a military-style operation, complete with coordinating deadlines. The emergency bill had to be ready by noon on Thursday when Congress assembled. Night after night, Roosevelt was still in his office after midnight struck, conferring with Moley, Treasury Secretary Bill Wooden, old Hooverites, bankers, and legislative draftsmen. The team worked around the clock, stealing time only to eat a sandwich, snooze on a couch, or take a shower. Early on, the decision was made to shore up weaker banks with federal funds. The Bureau of Engraving was ordered to begin printing new currency post-haste, and a fleet of airplanes was commandeered to stand by, ready to carry the money to banks across the country. By Wednesday, a first draft of the bill went to the White House. With the help of bank examiners and the Federal Reserve, Treasury officials had prepared a map with multicolored pins to differentiate a bank's status according to its soundness. Always partial to maps as a way of visually clarifying problems for himself or teaching others, Roosevelt was delighted with it, Moley reported. Later that evening, the draft was presented to the majority and minority leaders in both houses. After small changes, congressional leaders pledged their full support. Not until 3 o'clock in the morning was the bill sent to the printer. When asked if the bill was finished, the puckish Bill Wooden said,
"Yes, it is. Finished. My name is Bill, and I'm finished too."
The bill was essentially a conservative endeavor designed to patch up failings and shortcomings, to stabilize, not alter, the existing structure. While Roosevelt was already contemplating far-reaching structural changes in the banking community, it was necessary first to clear the financial arteries of the economy. Only if this opening gambit was successful could momentum be gained to address systemic problems. Unless this crisis was resolved, there could be no turnaround. Roosevelt was busy in conferences on Wednesday night until past midnight. While the details of the bill had been agreed upon, one further task remained: a presidential message to be sent to Congress prior to the bill's introduction.
Rising at 7 a.m., Roosevelt began composing that message in longhand. As each page was completed, the New York Times reported, it was copied on the typewriter and sent immediately to the executive office for stenciling. I cannot too strongly urge upon the Congress the clear necessity for immediate action, Roosevelt began. Our first task is to reopen all sound banks. This is an essential preliminary to subsequent legislation directed against speculation with the funds of depositors and other violations of positions of trust. First things must be first. In the short space of 5 days, it is impossible for us to formulate completed measures to prevent the recurrence of the evils of the past. But together they had set out, and soon, he pledged, he would propose action on a rounded program of national restoration that would mark the beginning of a new relationship between the banks and the people. For recovery without reform would only temporarily disguise, not remove, the original causes of the financial collapse. With 30 minutes to spare, the new administration met the first deadline. They delivered the prospective bill, or at least a single copy of it, before Congress gathered at noon on Thursday, March 9th. Here's the bill, Congressman Henry Stegall, chairman of the House Banking Committee, said, waving the single copy over his head. Let's pass it! House leaders ruled that no amendments could be offered, and the debate would be restricted to 40 minutes. Republican Minority Leader Bertrand Snell urged his colleagues to give the president carte blanche. The House is burning down, and the President of the United States says this is the way to put out the fire. With shouts of vote, vote, rising from the floor, a voice vote was taken. Not one voice of dissent broke the silence. By the time the Senate commenced its own debate, the newly printed copies of the bill were fully circulated. The few amendments offered by progressives to strengthen national regulation of the banks were swiftly shouted down. The final tally was 73 ayes, 7 nays, the latter mainly from agrarian progressives. 22 minutes later, the bill was shuttled to the White House for Roosevelt's signature. The signing ceremony took place in the Oval Room on the second floor that would become the president's study, but was presently a disheveled space with half-unpacked boxes and paintings waiting to be hung. Prior to the signing, Eleanor prompted her husband to comb his hair for the camera. Their Scottish terrier barked, and a clerk handed Roosevelt a pen to sign the first bill of his presidency. Less than 9 hours had passed since a special session of what would become the famous 100-Day Congress had opened. Such congressional dispatch had no equal. The president expressed his gratitude to Congress for the passage of the bill, particularly citing the unity that prevailed. While the Democrats now had huge majorities in both houses, the Republicans had backed every step of the rapidly evolving process. Still, Roosevelt understood that nothing yet had been accomplished. The true test would come on Monday morning, when the banks reopened. Then the American public would determine the fate of the financial system. Would they feel confident enough in the banks to redeposit their savings? If not, if they continued to further withdraw and hoard, the situation might well stampede into chaos. Roosevelt had 3 days left to present and solidify his case before the public. The time had come for the impresario who had coordinated a multi-layered team to prepare the bill and plan for its implementation to step from behind the curtain and assume the leading role in persuading the American people. set forth and maintain clear-cut ground rules with the press. As a first step in educating the public during those critical days, Roosevelt held two free-flowing press conferences that little resembled those held by earlier administrations.
"I am told that what I am about to do will become impossible," he told the 125 members of the press crammed in his office. "But I am going to try it."
The stakes of this experiment were high. Roosevelt's secretary noted that he was unusually nervous before starting. His hand was trembling, and he was wet with perspiration. Once the buzzer sounded and the members of the press filed into his office, however, there was no sign of the enormous pressure he was under. Amazingly, he looked fresh and fit, the New York Times reported. Former presidents had conducted irregular, often awkward meetings, relying upon previously submitted questions. Roosevelt proposed to discard written questions, hopeful for a semblance of give and take, to establish an arena where actual interchange might occur, a stage for genuine improvisation, and even whimsy, yet all within carefully prescribed ground rules. Direct quotations must be cleared with Press Secretary Steve Early. Background information could be used on the reporter's own authority, but not attributed to the White House. Off-the-record information must remain confidential, not even to be revealed to an editor or colleague.
"Because there's always the danger that while you people may not violate the rule, somebody may forget."
Roosevelt envisioned regular bi-weekly press conferences as settings for mutual education, not confrontation. A former editor of the Harvard Crimson himself, he respected journalists and understood that they had jobs to do, just as he had his. They wanted access to ascertain what was happening. He wanted to disseminate his own narrative in his own way. The style of his press conferences reflected the style of the man. This was no forum for heated debate, confrontation, or any manner of aggression. There prevailed only the simple demand for a cordial, good-humored, and civil exchange. Roosevelt was well acquainted with the novel ways in which his cousin Theodore had engaged and entertained the press. Every day at 1 o'clock, reporters were invited to the former president's midday shave, the barber's hour, when they were permitted to question, or more accurately, listen, as Theodore expounded upon any number of subjects, while the barber desperately tried to ply his trade. Later in the day, reporters were welcomed back when the president began his daily task of sorting correspondence. A quarter of a century later, Franklin Roosevelt proposed to formalize these encounters through the invention of a new manner of press conference, one that would reconceive the relationship between press and president. If the ground rules were not respected, he half-jokingly threatened to revive the Ananias Club, an institution established by Theodore Roosevelt, to which journalists who printed untruthful or fabricated items were banished from the proceedings. The name was chosen to commemorate a disciple of Jesus who was struck dead after lying to Peter the Apostle. In the nearly 1,000 press conferences Franklin Roosevelt held after these first two, violations of the basic ground rules rarely occurred.
"We were antagonists," one journalist remarked, "but we liked each other, and we laughed, and we had a perfect understanding of what each was trying to do."
After setting out the rules, Roosevelt generated the first round of laughter by announcing,
"Now, as to news, I don't think there is any."
The genial tone was sustained throughout the entire conference as he responded to questions simply and unhurriedly, as if he were sitting at a table talking to an old friend. If he didn't know enough to provide an answer, he would simply say so. But,
"Oh," he exclaimed,
I'm learning a lot about banking.
The Baltimore Sun reporter designated it the most amazing performance of its kind the White House has ever seen. Roosevelt relished the rough and tumble of the initial experiment, and when it concluded, the press corps, transformed into an appreciative audience, applauded. To compound the innovative nature of the new administration, Eleanor Roosevelt held her own first press conference at the same time that day. She made a rule that only female reporters could attend, which meant that all over the country, conservative publishers had to hire their first female reporters. Indeed, because of Eleanor Roosevelt's weekly press conferences, an entire generation of female journalists got their start. The New York Times characterized this first week as so swift-moving and momentous that it contained as many major events as have occurred in the entire administrations of some presidents, little knowing that the momentum gained had just begun. Tell the story simply, directly to the people. On the Sunday eve of the decisive Monday morning of the bank reopenings on March 13th, Roosevelt delivered the first of what became known as his fireside chats. At various times throughout the previous week, he had sketched out and rehearsed the story of the banking crisis. At the initial gathering of the cabinet, he had outlined the banking dilemma in what seemed to Francis Perkins remarkably lucid and straightforward terms. Subsequently, the narrative was further pruned, revised, and simplified for the members of Congress and the assembled press. Now, he was finally ready to go before the American people. Roosevelt had earlier perused the draft provided by the Treasury Department and tried to demystify the language of the legal and banking community. He sought to translate their specialized language into words of one syllable that could be better understood by himself and the average citizen. By a mason at work on a new building, he said, a girl behind a counter, a farmer in his field. At last, seated at a desk before six microphones and a small assemblage of family and colleagues, he imagined the American people listening in their parlors or kitchens. My friends, he opened, striking an immediate intimacy. As he spoke, Perkins recalled, his face would smile and light up. He was not merely talking directly to the people of the nation, observed Rosenman, but rather to each person in the nation. I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days, why it was done, and what the next steps are going to be, he began. Abraham Lincoln had provided a similar roadmap of orientation when he set out to tell the story of how the House Divided had come about, and how the people could come together to reunify that House. If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could then better judge what to do and how to do it. So Roosevelt, like Lincoln, sought to communicate with and guide his audience by telling a story. When you deposit money in a bank, Roosevelt explained, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in bonds, loans, and mortgages, to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning around. In normal times, the cash on hand is sufficient to cover the needs of depositors. What then happened? A number of banks had used the money entrusted to them in speculations and unwise loans. When the market crashed and these banks collapsed, confidence in the entire banking system was undermined. A general rush to withdraw took place. A rush so great that the soundest banks could not get enough currency to meet the demand. Now, backed by the new federal pledge to provide loans and additional currency if necessary, approved banks could safely begin to open their doors again. "I can assure you," he reasoned, "that it is safer to keep your money in a reopened bank than under the mattress." He identified the very questions the people asked themselves and urgently needed answering. "A question you will ask is this: why are all the banks not to be reopened at the same time?" The answer is simple. The process of determining which banks could open immediately and which needed help would take time. "A bank that opens on one of the subsequent days," he assured them, "is in exactly the same status as the bank that opens tomorrow." He would not promise that no individual would be subject to losses, but if the country had continued to drift, far greater losses would have been suffered. Again, as in the inaugural, he asked the people for courage and faith. "Let us unite in banishing fear. We have provided the machinery to restore our financial system. It is up to you to make it work." The man and the moment had converged. Roosevelt had grasped the revolutionary opportunity radio presented. That marvelous 20th century invention which has all but annihilated time, distance, and space. An estimated 60 million people listened to the president's radio chat. His soft, relaxed, and modulated speaking voice was naturally attuned to the conversational style of the new radio age. This fireside chat was precisely that, an interchange rather than an oration. Most importantly, his voice projected empathy, confidence, and warmth that made one believe and trust in his words. As the White House nervously apprehended, however, the true test would be the people's reaction when banks reopened. Early reports suggested long lines at teller windows, but it was a run to make new deposits, not to take money out. Headlines in city after city told the selfsame story. "City recovers confidence," the Chicago Tribune proclaimed. "Rush to put money back shows restored faith as holiday ends," declared the New York Times. Many depositors cited the renewed confidence the president's radio chat had given them. A bank president in San Antonio noted that the customers seemed to be an entirely different list of people than those who had scrambled to remove their money weeks before. "Their names and signatures are the same, but their frame of mind is as different as day and night." With simple, plain language, devoid of metaphors or eloquence, Roosevelt had accomplished his purpose of explanation and persuasion. The banking crisis that had gripped the country with fear and panic subsided. When trading resumed on Wednesday, the stock market registered a 15% jump, its largest rise in years. By the standard of its impact on events, this first fireside chat, one historian noted, ranks as one of the most important speeches in U.S. history. The patient had survived the acute crisis. Only now, to prevent relapse, could the doctor propose a regimen to treat the sources of that disease. Address systemic problems, launch lasting reforms. Roosevelt had initially planned for Congress to adjourn after the emergency banking legislation had passed. He soon realized, however, that the momentum generated from the first victory should not be squandered. Accordingly, he asked congressional leaders to remain in continuous session, a request that would beget the historic turnaround that would become known as the 100 Days. "The process of recovery," Roosevelt understood from the start, would require the removal of the destructive influences of the past, the uprooting of old abuses, so they could not readily grow again. Over and over he spoke of the condition the country faced as an organic disease, an affliction with multiple sites. What were these old abuses, these destructive influences of the past, these sore spots that hindered prospects for a lasting cure? To Roosevelt's thinking, the essential obstacle lay in an industrial capitalism that had remained largely unregulated save for brief spates of progressive legislation under Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Systemic problems had festered for a whole generation before the Great Depression exposed their catastrophic effects. The pathology Franklin Roosevelt diagnosed entailed the entire economic and social structure. It went to the roots of our agriculture, our commerce, our industry. It was his conviction that recovery demanded nothing less than a complete reorganization and a measured control of the economic structure. This could only be attained by supplanting the old pyramidal order of special privilege with a new order of things designed to benefit the great mass of our farmers, workers, and businessmen. As Roosevelt had anticipated, no sooner was the banking crisis resolved than a vocal minority began to cry out that reform should be placed on a shelf and not taken down until after recovery progressed. That minority offered growing resistance to the far-flung activist plans contemplated by the New Deal. Those at the pyramid's apex still believed that by saving the banks and bailing out corporations, prosperity would trickle down to the benefit of the people at large. They refused, Roosevelt said, to realize that recovery and reform must be permanent partners in permanent well-being. If recovery of the banks had been a decisive initiating battle, reform would be a widespread, protracted war. Roosevelt decided to unveil his vision for systematic economic and social reform in a second fireside chat on May 7, 1933. So sweeping were the changes he intended to espouse that his speechwriter Moley called his attention to the fact that he was taking a giant step away from the laissez-faire philosophy that kept private enterprise free from government intrusion and considered all regulation anathema.
Roosevelt looked graver than he had been at any moment since the night before his inauguration, Moley remembered. And then, when he had been silent a few minutes, he said, "If that philosophy hadn't proved to be bankrupt, Herbert Hoover would be sitting here right now."
Roosevelt began his second radio conversation, building upon his first fireside chat on the banking crisis 8 weeks before. In the same spirit and by the same means, he would discuss general plans to remedy deeply implanted problems and to sketch the purpose behind the specific policies. Never should the American people try to revert to the old order. The emergent order Roosevelt had in mind was not the coercive imposition of government control, but the concept of a partnership between government, farming, industry, and transportation. At the center of this new collaboration stood a revolutionary bond between the president and the great rank and file of the people as his partners in the government. Comfort did not reside in bombast. "We cannot ballyhoo ourselves back to prosperity," he cautioned. The country's descent could be reversed only by coordinated action. He asked Congress for a staggering array of governmental programs, which, taken together, would redefine the role of the federal government to regulate the economy and secure the lives of the American people from the bottom to the top. His purpose, to rebuild the social system on sounder foundations and on sounder lines, sprang from what Francis Perkins called his general attitude that the people mattered. Before Congress adjourned on its 100th day, 15 major pieces of legislation had been passed and signed into law. Billions of dollars were appropriated to undertake massive public works, provide direct work relief, ease mortgage distress, safeguard investors, guarantee bank deposits, ensure decent wages, provide collective bargaining, raise agricultural prices, generate public power. Relieve, ease, safeguard, guarantee, ensure. All words designed to bring comfort to those who were suffering. Words that connoted policies that had begun to weave the vast safety net of protection and regulation that would eventually become the New Deal. Contemporaries were boggled, filled with a sense of wonder upon witnessing the leadership exercised by Franklin Roosevelt during the 100-day turnaround and beyond. Then as now, one asks, how was it possible for a single man to give coherence to multiple layers of new programs cutting across the entire economic and social spectrum? Be open to experiment. Design flexible agencies to deal with new problems. First off, Roosevelt stressed the improvisational, experimental nature of the New Deal. Confronting the unmapped ocean of human distress the Depression had wrought, Roosevelt had little in the way of precedent to guide either the formulation or the execution of policies. With a bewildering array of sweeping laws to execute, he had no choice, he believed, but to experiment with unorthodox administrative practices. "We have new and complex problems," Roosevelt explained. "We don't really know what they are. Why not establish a new agency to take over the new duty, rather than saddle it to an old institution?" Old-line departments were inevitably accustomed to familiar routines, established ways of thinking and acting. New agencies would be free to create new cultures built around innovation, vitality, and speed. In the course of his first 18 months, Roosevelt would create 20 new agencies from the alphabet soup and give them names that would become known by their acronyms. Roosevelt's first venture, the Civilian Conservation Corps, popularly called the CCC, bore the signature of his personal invention. Francis Perkins once remarked that every now and then, Roosevelt would have flashes of almost clairvoyant knowledge and understanding. The CCC, which linked all kinds of disparate things together in an original, romantic, yet practical program, was just such a concept. The program, when initially announced in March, aimed to provide work and purpose for 250,000 young men by mid-July. Most lived in cities, had recently left school, and were seeking an opportunity to make their own way. Nowhere could jobs be found, and they were listless and depressed. At the same time, dozens of national forests had fallen into a sad state of neglect over the years, to become choking third and fourth growth tracts of scrubland. Dead trees and shrubs had to be cleared, new trees planted, firewalls built, paths cleared. The CCC would heal the forests while healing the young men. Since the greater portion of the wages would be sent home, earnings would simultaneously help families and stimulate local economies adjacent to the camps. A practical measure for the present and a material investment in the future, the CCC, as envisioned by Roosevelt, planted trees while more importantly planting a moral and spiritual value to uplift and sustain a generation of young men adrift. When Roosevelt first described the plan to the cabinet, Perkins considered it a pipe dream. How would 250,000 young men be recruited? How would they be transported to the forests, clothed, fed, and housed? Who would design and supervise the work projects? How could the program possibly be up and running in 3 months' time? The answers to all such questions lay in Roosevelt's leadership style. Establish a clear purpose. Challenge the team to work out details. Traverse conventional departmental boundaries. Set large short-term and long-term targets. Create tangible success to generate accelerated growth and momentum. Over the course of several cabinet discussions, an overall method to actualize Roosevelt's conception took shape. Four departments would contribute to this unique collaboration. The Labor Department was to select and enroll the young men from the relief roles. Interior and Agriculture would recommend the work sites and design site-appropriate projects. The Army was to construct camps, transport, feed, clothe, house, and pay the men. Reserve Army officers would return to active duty to run the camps. The Interior Department was to select civilian foremen to oversee the work. To lead the CCC and coordinate the interdepartmental operations, Roosevelt shrewdly selected Robert Feschner, a union leader whose career had begun as a machinist. When Roosevelt asked him how long he needed to set up his first camp, Feschner replied, "A month." Roosevelt countered, "Too long." At once, Feschner halved the estimate. "Good," Roosevelt said simply. By calling for 250,000 men to occupy the forest camps by mid-July, Roosevelt challenged his team to exceed normal standards by setting a target beyond all conventional expectations. "Do it now, and I won't take any excuses," he told them. It was characteristic of him that he conceived the project boldly, rushed it through, and happily left it to others to worry about the details, Perkins later said. He put the dynamite under the people who had to do the job and let them fumble for their own methods. And his entire team responded. By early July, Roosevelt proudly declared, more than 250,000 men were at work in 1,500 camps. "The most rapid, large-scale mobilization of men in our history." The Labor Department had managed to enroll 10,000 men daily until the target was reached. A cadre of talented officers, including Colonel George Marshall, had erected camps to accommodate more men than had been deployed in the Spanish-American War. The Corps members, deeply engaged in a wide variety of conservation tasks, had found a place in the world. They were to make an enduring transformation of the infrastructure of public lands, improving timberland, securing flood and fire control, managing and conserving forest land for generations to come. The CCC proved to be among the most popular of the New Deal programs. More than 2.5 million young men would pass through the camps before the program was discontinued after the outbreak of World War II. Many of these men had never seen a forest before, let alone dwelled in a natural setting. Few had performed arduous manual labor, but, as Roosevelt had hopefully foreseen, they developed a broad range of job skills and learned to labor alongside others from different
hitherto unknown parts of the country.
I weighed about 160 pounds when I went there, and when I left, I was 190,
said one boy, filled with a newfound sense of self-respect.
It made a man of me, all right.
Roosevelt understood, of course, that the CCC was not a panacea, for despite its initial success, the 250,000 CCC jobs comprised but 1/60th of the problem of 15 million unemployed Americans. To better illustrate the situation, he reverted to a sports analogy. He likened himself to the quarterback of a football team who
has a general plan of game in mind.
He knew what his first play was going to be, but could not tell you the play after that, until the next play is run off.
If the play makes 10 yards, the succeeding play will be different from what it would have been if they had been thrown for a loss.
The resounding success of the CCC had provided an enabling first play in the intricate game plan that was just beginning to unfold for dealing with the colossal unemployment problem. Stimulate competition and debate, encourage creativity. Roosevelt worked most productively, Sam Rosenman believed, when ideas and arguments, pro and con, would be batted out before him, discussed and debated. He surrounded himself with strong personalities who fought hard for their own ideas, and then he deliberately contrived situations that challenged them to defend their opposing positions. Finally, of great importance, he steered them into reconciliation. Time and again, defying orthodox administrative protocol, he would give the same assignment to different people in the same agency, or allocate the same project to different agencies.
There is something to be said for having a little conflict, Roosevelt observed. A little rivalry is stimulating, you know. It keeps everybody going to prove that he is a better fellow than the next man.
While Roosevelt himself never felt threatened by multiplicity and confusion, the inherently disorderly nature of his administration frequently disgruntled subordinates. At times, morale was threatened and feelings were rankled. The maintenance of peace in his official family, Roosevelt's secretary Grace Tully remarked, took up hours and days of Roosevelt's time. When he determined that a member of his team was feeling undervalued or under pressure, he sprang into action. He would invite the aggrieved aide to the White House for a hand-holding session. One administrator observed that Roosevelt had a rare capacity for healing the wounded feelings which he had inadvertently caused.
In a quieter time, when problems were routine, there would have been every reason to demand a tight and tidy administration, Schlesinger remarked. But a time of crisis placed a premium on initiative and innovation, and on an organization of government which gave these qualities leeway and reward.
By leaving lines of authority ambiguous, Roosevelt could simultaneously move in different directions. He could allow members of his spirited team to run, never doubting his ability to rein them in. Moreover, by refusing to delegate or consolidate too much power in a single person, he kept the ultimate decisions just where he wanted them, in his own hands. Nowhere was Roosevelt's competitive theory of administration illustrated more revealingly than in the struggle between two extremely able men, Harold Ickes and Harry Hopkins, for control of the billions of dollars allocated to relieve unemployment through public works. As Secretary of Interior and Director of the Public Works Administration, PWA, Ickes had the perspective of a progressive businessman. The best way to attack unemployment, he believed, was to prime the pump by subsidizing private contractors to construct immense projects that would take an extended period of time to complete, but once accomplished, would endure. Such projects included the Bonneville Dam, the Lincoln Tunnel, LaGuardia Airport,
and the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Harry Hopkins, a former social worker who headed the Civil Works Administration, CWA, and later the Works Progress Administration, WPA, favored a multifarious range of smaller and decentralized projects deliberately designed to get as many people off the relief rolls and into actual jobs as quickly as possible. Such speedily mobilized community-centered projects included many hundreds of schools, libraries, firehouses, playgrounds, skating rinks, and swimming pools. The Federal Arts Project sponsored painted murals for public buildings. The Federal Theater Project enabled live productions of classical works to reach people in far-flung regions. The contrasting administrative styles of the two men mirrored their differing philosophies and temperaments. Known as Honest Herald, Ickes was a seasoned administrator determined to restore the reputation of an interior department badly damaged by the Teapot Dome scandal during the Harding administration. Ickes insisted on meticulous planning. He micromanaged every contract, ever watchful for waste or scandal. A scrupulous disciplinarian, he arrived early and remained late at his desk in the ornate interior building. Until the voice of public disapproval was raised, he locked the front doors at 8:35 a.m. to prevent employees from wandering in late, and even removed bathroom stall doors to discourage employees from reading newspapers. Hopkins, a chain smoker and black coffee drinker who occupied the shabbiest building in Washington, often looked as if he had slept at his desk, wearing the same shirt 3 or 4 days at a time. Impatient with bureaucracy and averse to organizational charts, he focused obsessively on the physical, mental, and spiritual suffering caused by the dearth of jobs. He believed that direct relief in the form of the dole undermined character and independence, and that men and women desperately wanted and needed the dignity of work and the discipline labor gave to one's life. When critics complained that the CWA jobs were often of short duration with little impact on the long-run economy, he countered, "People don't eat in the long run. They eat every day." Franklin Roosevelt valued, needed, and would utilize and reconcile the philosophies of both men. He sought both short and long-term benefits, decentralized immediate work projects, and centralized durable improvements,